listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at JackieDaily.com. Jackie, no E, daily like every day. Also on Twitter at JackieDailyHost, the all-new, all-free Twitter, we're hoping. And then Instagram and Facebook, I have not been able to give it up, but you can find me there too. So, this show, I will speak with my friend Ron Ness. He's the director of the North Dakota Petroleum Council and a director of the Council for a Secure America. We're going to talk about why, when the number one polling issue is inflation for the last election, what it really is number one polling issue is oil and gas and coal. That is the makeup of the increase in price, along with supply chain issues. But basically, it's built into the cost of everything you buy. And when the cost skyrockets, as now, you will feel it in every product. Literally, you do not buy one single product that isn't brought to you by fossil fuels, either because it's made of oil or hydrocarbons, or because it was transported to you with diesel fuel, likely, or on train, or because it was manufactured with electricity, and that means natural gas and coal. It's just unavoidable and built into the cost of everything. So Ron Ness knows all about that and the geopolitical impact if a state like his, North Dakota, gets to produce at full throttle. That would help to defund Putin's war. And he will explain it. And then we'll speak to my new friend, Major Fred Galvin. He spent 26 years plus in the U.S. Marine Corps, including in Marine Special Operations Command, or MARSOC. He wrote a book. It's called A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. What really caught my attention about the story is that after living through and enduring the longest trial in Marine Corps history for alleged war crimes, he was acquitted, and they were all acquitted. And there's reason to believe, and he will make the case forcefully, that he was subject to a political persecution by generals in the U.S. military and others for political reasons. And, you know, typically if you're acquitted, that's because they didn't have the facts in the first place. The case should never have been brought. You should never have been indicted. It is awfully suspicious, as we see this long string now of acquittals. Former administration officials, people like Major Galvin. What is going on? And so he has a theory for why this happens. His book is the true story. Again, it's titled A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. And though it is not an explicit piece of the book, one thing that I came away with is that there's a lot of wisdom in the policy that President Trump had to ban forever, for life, lobbying by former administration officials for a foreign government. As an American, you should absolutely insist on that. I mean, because right now, it doesn't matter whether they're Democrat or Republican. This is a bipartisan problem. If they serve as a cabinet official or as a general at the top levels of U.S. policy and government, you will find they leave their job and often go directly for work to people who are lobbying them or for whom massive appropriations flowed out of their agencies to, say, a defense contractor or to someone else. It is impossible for me to believe that these people are not compromised, that someone is not dangling carrots in front of their eyes while they are in office wanting certain results. And I think that a book like Major Galvin's can help explain why the United States would leave billions and billions of dollars worth of military equipment in the hands of the Taliban in Afghanistan. I mean, this shocked and disgusted the entire country. Why would we do that? And people ask, how can we be so incompetent? Well, I believe it's not incompetence. I don't think it's accidental. You have to understand, those billions of dollars made people rich. Someone got rich off of that, and someone, several someones, inside the U.S. government had to call that shot. to make that transaction happen. Period. That's what's going on. And if ever a communist was right about anything, you'll recall the famous quote that the communist said that the capitalist will sell us the rope that we'll use to hang them. And that's what's happening. Here's the problem. You don't need a lot of sellouts. And by the way, they're not sellouts legally. This stuff is all legal. What I'm describing to you is not a crime. It's not a crime. I would call it disloyalty. Some would call it treason. But as it stands today, it is perfectly legal for them to do what they do. All they need is an articulable reason for why their decision made sense, and there is no consequence. We've watched it happen year after year after year. And, you know, it's not just a handful of adversaries who get to these people. And unfortunately, all you need is a few people with weak morals or weak loyalty at the top, and a whole lot of evil can happen. Again, that's not the central part of this story. The central part of Major Galvin's story is his true life account of when he was in Afghanistan in 2007, was ambushed in a horrific attack by the Taliban. And the next thing he knows, after he's fought his way out of it and survived, he's being prosecuted. And the NCIS is apparently taking the word of the Afghans on the ground against our own military in conflicting accounts, according to Major Galvin. So he'll tell you all about that. It's three segments. I think it's a great interview. And just every time I see a story like this where an American patriot or hero who put it all in the line gets prosecuted for doing the right thing and then acquitted, which proved in a court of law, according to standards of proof and according to the rules of evidence, that they were innocent all along. I want you to know about that. I want these people to be redeemed. I want you to hear their stories, and I want you to know that they weren't what the media said they were, what their supervisor said they were, what the leadership said they were. They will never get their lives back entirely, but we should do what we can to tell these stories and make sure people know that actually some people fight and win. They come out ahead. They win. Despite all of the pain and suffering and all the attempted destruction, some people do thrive, in fact. And finally, I ran across a law review article at Belmont Law School, which it turns out the faculty advisor is a classmate of mine. His name is Jeffrey Usman, one of the smartest people I've ever known. Under his supervision, they have an article titled Global Energy Poverty. Global Energy Poverty, The Relevance of Faith and Reason, by a man named Lakshman Guruswamy. Lakshman Guruswamy. Spring 2020, actually, and I'm just now seeing it because I went to a conference where it was being handed out. And not only does it explain the concept of energy poverty, which I think is the key to communicating with millennials and Generation Z. I mean, they're very, very socially conscious. They think globally. They want to do the right thing by their own account. This law review article, ironically, because normally this would not be in a law review, but it goes through sociology and anthropology and economics and explains how when you're arguing, like Greta Thunberg, to withdraw oil, gas, and coal from the world, which is 80% of our energy, you truly are calling for these people who are living in the worst poverty imaginable to remain in that condition, if not worse. Literally millions of people die every year from not having clean drinking water, not having clean air, because they have to burn biomass to cook and to stay alive. And we would have not just 1.2 billion people living that way. We would all be living that way if they actually had their dreams come true, their Greta Thunberg dreams come true. They don't understand this. But if you can explain, and this law review article does, the connection between how much fossil fuels you burn and the standard of living and health that you have, then it all makes sense. So I will share the relevant pieces later in the show, summarizing it for you. But should you be inclined, again, it's Belmont Law Review. The article is titled Global Energy Poverty, The Relevance of Faith and Reason by Lakshman Goswami. I enjoyed it. All right, you're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online, jackiedaily.com. Jackie, no E, daily like every day. And on Twitter, at Jackie Daily Host, Instagram, and Facebook. So I ran across yet another story of great Americans being persecuted for doing their job or otherwise standing up for what they're supposed to be standing up for, and being essentially driven to the point of having to defend themselves in a court of law for their actions. I've been reporting every one of these stories I can find, whether it is the Department of Justice going after people who exercise free speech, going after people who question the integrity of elections, or going after American service members who are overseas in harm's way for us for what appear to be spurious charges. Because you know what happens? I'm only reporting the stories where people are acquitted, found to have committed no wrong, yet running the gauntlet at the hands of their own government. So I found a story like this, yet another. It's about Major Fred Galvin, U.S. Marine Corps retired. It's a book called A Few Bad Men, the true story of U.S. Marines ambushed in Afghanistan and betrayed in America. This is a true story. An elite team of U.S. Marines. I understand Major Galvin has been with MARSOC, which is Marine Special Operations Command. And really, for 26 years, was at many levels of the Corps. So here's a person who's given his life to defending the country and found himself on the receiving end of overzealous prosecutors and likely activists who worked their way into our system. So he's joining me today, the author, Major Galvin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate having me, Jackie.
Absolutely. So first of all, this is, or your book is billed as a cross between A Few Good Men and American Sniper. This is an elite Marine Special Operations unit. You were shot during an Afghanistan ambush and falsely accused, essentially, of gunning down innocent Afghan civilians following the ambush. You were the unit leader, and you were, as I understand it, relieved of your duty. Your unit was taken out of the combat zone. You were condemned, even by American generals. And then the target of, I didn't know this, the first court of inquiry in the Marines in 50 years. Explain what that means.
Yes, Jackie, this is something that some of your listeners may know of because they heard it in the news. Some of them may not. I need to explain the difference and why. So we were the very first Marine Special Operations company that deployed. We went to Afghanistan. We were hand-selected. I picked these men. We trained them for a year. We were in eastern Afghanistan, right there in the Tor Bor Mountains, where Osama bin Laden had last been seen by American forces. We were given a mission to conduct aggressive combat operations. This was a mixed signal. I didn't get the wink and the nod, Jackie, that they didn't really want us to do anything at all. But the mission, as it was stated in writing, was to conduct aggressive combat operations. My Marines and myself, we'd been on multiple deployments in combat in Iraq during the height of the insurgency, but I never had somebody say aggressive combat operations. So we're thinking we need to step this up. Unfortunately, this was time frame is 2007. So similar puts us in a time frame like we're in right now, where we're going for a run up to a general election. In Iraq, at that time, they had a full-length page ad saying, "General, betray us," a hit ad, because the U.S. commander in charge of all forces in Iraq, General Petraeus, was surging forces. There's over 100,000 American forces on the ground. It's very bloody. is very unpopular in the press. Now, we get in this ambush in Afghanistan, which had been fairly much a success story at that time. But we didn't just get shot at, like you described. We were blown up by a car bomb, not just filled with shrapnel from mortar rounds, but filled with fuel intended to burn those of us in that patrol. And that creates psychological damage to American when, as Afghans, they're very skilled. These are terrorists, talking Taliban here, not just Afghans. They're skilled at using terrorism and using psychological warfare. And when you see someone, which unfortunately several of us have, that's burned either to death or has the skin melt on their bodies, that puts some hesitancy to re-enter the battlefield on the next engagement. But so that morning at 9 o'clock in the morning, we entered this village. The atmospherics had totally changed. Saw a total 180 shift in the baseline. There's no women and children. And we've ever seen a mass exodus of women and children. We know something's about ready to go on. So as we re-entered that village to do this meet and greet, and General Petraeus and General Mattis had believed in this forever war strategy that pinned this counterinsurgency doctrine of winning the hearts and minds. Well, it doesn't really work like that when you believe in Sharia law and killing infidel. As we entered this village, it was nothing but fighting age men lined up on both sides of that road. And as soon as we slowed down to conduct this meet and greet, because we had to have chai and tea with the elders, we were hit with this car bomb. It's a van, Jackie, filled with explosives and fuel, detonated right in the front of our patrol, knocked the gunner down inside the vehicle that it detonated point blank on. He immediately stands back to his feet, demonstrating the courage of a Marine Corps sergeant. He's on fire, shrapnel in his body, mans a machine gun, sees a sports utility vehicle, a Toyota Prado, heading ready to T-bone him perpendicular. And he, as well as one other Marine in the rear troop compartment, stand up, engage with their machine guns, and make quick work of the jihadists that were firing their AK-47s fully automatic at us. I was there on the patrol, saw it with my own eyes, 9 o'clock in the morning. The driver of that vehicle bailed out of the vehicle, continued to fight from the ditch that he was using for concealment. He later testified on the longest, this was the longest war crimes trial in American history, 3.5 weeks in the courtroom. This was the highest number of alleged civilian casualties killed by machine guns in the entire war in Afghanistan. We expect the enemy, Jackie, to sensationalize, use propaganda, information warfare to spin the truth. We expected to be targeted by kinetic and non-kinetic actions by the Taliban. What we didn't expect is what happened to us, and still brings the memories of being hunted by our own men when the entire U.S. military comes down on seven of us who were on the patrol named in that investigation for homicide. This was the largest count, as I said, 19 alleged killed, 50 wounded, of which they said was women, children, elderly. They even said bovine creatures. It's a you read a few bad men and you go to Appendix 3 and you see all the Afghan statements and you get a sense of this is absurd. They completely contradict each other. How could General Jim Mattis, who was Lieutenant General at that time and who was the convening authority, how could he believe such ridiculousness? And we don't put 3 and 4 stars on men and women in the Pentagon or down in Tampa at the Central Command that are drunken idiots, that are morons. No, they knew what they were doing. And the Afghans, the Taliban, said that we were drunk, that we dismounted from our vehicles, that we went door to door sport killing men, women, children. And if they really believe that, then why, after they relieved me, why would they send me to be put in charge of the entire training program for all of Marine Special Operations, not just the task force that I commanded, but they sent me back, put me in charge of all the training. That defies logic.
Right.
Well, it makes perfect sense if you knew that that's not what happened. They had the intelligence of what had been going on in that village, what went on afterwards. This was, think in your heads, compare it to an Amazon fulfillment center. So this is right on the Afghan-Pakistan border. They fully radicalized in this sanctuary, which we couldn't go to in Pakistan, all of the foreign fighters. And then they'd bring them across in this paved road that was paid by from U.S. taxpayer dollars, the only paved road in Afghanistan. They come right in, and then that first village, guess what that is? That's a distribution node. And they link up with all their handlers for their last mile delivery to Kabul, Kandahar, you name it, and trying to kill the infidel. And so they wanted people, especially Americans, to stay away from this area. We had good intelligence. We entered that village, got blown up, got shot out on both sides of the road. They dragged a vehicle across the road. A mass mob swarmed at us. We started getting receiving sniper fire on our patrol as evidence from the impacts from the steel that the U.S. Army Criminal Investigative Division determined from their forensics was impacts from a Soviet Dragunov sniper rifle. But Jackie, they sent, when you read the book, everybody says, this is very disturbing that you guys were hunted down, that they actually sent an Air Force colonel. That makes no sense to investigate, you know, Marine Special Operations Company. But when you see that, okay, we want to hang these guys out to dry, and here's a made man, a wise guy, it makes perfect sense. And every single person you see that threw us under the bus, and the title is A Few Bad Men. It's not tearing down the military. It's actions of a few. It's more than just a few, but what they did, and you see that last half of the book, when it goes into the courtroom and just prior, all those statements in there were what you can find on the internet right now. They're public statements made by generals to the press during an ongoing criminal investigation. So disregard the presumption of innocence. Disregard anything that says in the apex of the Supreme Court, equal justice under the law. Just get rid of that for Marine commandos, hand-selected, personally trained by myself for a year, that were blown up, shot at, sniped at, trapped in a kill zone. We fought our way out. We didn't kill any civilians. That's what all 30 of our statements said. That's what my polygraph stated. No deception indicated. And the military leaders, they knew it. And you read chapter 26, Jackie, you see every single one of those guys got, you know, their promotions.
Yep.
Went parabolic.
Yep.
They got away with it.
Okay, hold that thought because I have to get a break, but I definitely want to pick this right back up. I'm talking to Major Fred Galvin, who was on the receiving end of really the longest trial in Marine Corps history. And understand this ultimately led to an acquittal. He was acquitted, apparently, along with the others. We'll learn more about this when we come back. Again, the name of the book is A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Major Fred Galvin, who served over 26 years enlisted and as an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps, including in MARSOC, which is Marine Special Operations Command. He led hundreds of combat missions, including raids, deep reconnaissance, ship seizures, and ambush operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gulf of Aden, and elsewhere. And he's written a book called A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. What caught my attention when I was looking into this book is the fact that these heroes who are trained to be the best of the best in the fighting forces and first to fight were actually run through this gauntlet legally by our own leadership and were found to have been innocent. They were acquitted. And I'm seeing this over and over and over again. Some of the finest people in the country on the receiving end of persecution by their own government. Why is this happening? So I'm interested in these stories. I want to bring them to you. And, you know, it's everything from overzealous prosecutors fining farmers $75,000 a day for alleged environmental crimes with wetlands they didn't know about on their property to people standing up for free speech. Here we have an example of someone who served, and in this case, in Afghanistan, and was up against the Taliban. And if you're missing, or you missed the first segment, you're just joining us, essentially was ambushed. This was all about not just being shot at, but also an IED that detonated and was intended to incinerate these people. They fought their way out of it and then found themselves on the wrong end after surviving that of General Mattis and others who put them on trial. Again, the longest trial in Marine Corps history, where they were acquitted. So, Major Galvin, I want to go back to, you said a few things like that the leadership, the generals, they knew what they were doing. You were thrown under the bus. It sounds like a show trial. Explain to me and us what was happening there. Why was there value for them in putting you through this? Why did this happen?
Again, deals with the same kind of climate that we're going into now, going into a general election. You had, let me give a little bit of color in the backdrop of what was going on at that time. You had cases such as the Corporal Pat Tillman friendly fire case. There's five investigations. The mother of Patrick Tillman, Mary Tillman, had wanted to get to the truth. It was covered up. They knew about this. This case, the Pat Tillman case, a case with Second Lieutenant Lario Pantano in Fallujah, a Marine infantry officer, the Hadithic case in Hamdaniya in Iraq, which were other cases that Marines were involved in. They found in these four cases that military commanders, up to include a two-star Marine general, failed to act swiftly and investigate completely. So when Congressman Jack Murtha, a Vietnam veteran, prejudged and used bias in his public comments about Marines and Haditha, said that these Marines killed innocent Iraqi civilians in cold blood, then the tides changed. Then this happens with us. The political stage is going into an election between McCain and Obama. Hey, here's what the GOP can definitely assure to bring more of is a longer, bloodier war like you're seeing right now, meltdown in Iraq with 100,000 American forces, people getting killed on the news every day. Now we got Marines mass murdering civilians in Afghanistan. Is this what you want? So we were the pawns being played. The generals decided, okay, we're not going to have any of this. They made public statements. Major General Frank Kearney came out to the Washington Post, made repeated public statements. General, who was at that time a colonel, John Nicholson, he retired as a four-star general because they promoted so fastly afterwards. These virtue signalers, you know, I wouldn't do that. His public statements to the Pentagon press corps were that this was a terrible, terrible mistake. This was a stain on our honor that innocent Afghan civilians were killed by Americans. Those were his quoted words to the press. You had the commandant of the Marine Corps who had a conversation with the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Frank Pace, Marine, senior officer in our U.S. military, chairman, and made a public statement to the press saying, I spoke with the commandant of the Marine Corps, and he was indeed disappointed in these Marines. So you make all that during an ongoing criminal investigation. Military courts are very different than civilian courts because the convening authority, in this case, General Mattis, you know, he controls the promotions, the retention, the next assignments. So that doesn't happen in the civilian world. Your job, Jackie, is not controlled by a judge, whether you get promoted or assigned or get a bonus or anything. So the quality of life that you have, it's irregardless of somebody wearing a robe. But General Mattis, he knew. He sent 45 criminal investigators, four prosecuting attorneys. They threatened to have the driver of that vehicle, who was a sergeant, legally joined the Marine Corps, legally immigrated, legally naturalized from Mexico. They threatened to deport his mother. This isn't some embellishment. Google search Fred Galvin, ABC, watch the video, watch this young Marine describe it in his own words. This went on, this thug tactics, this isn't some Gestapo in Germany. This is the United States Marine Corps doing it to themselves so people could point the finger, be the critic, condemn us, and they got promoted and they got away with it. And they lied and covered it up. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was the commandant of the Marine Corps, General Dunford, told four members from where I'm from in Kansas, Missouri, all those U.S. senators, as well as Congressman Jones from the district that I was station in North Carolina, said that nothing happened to any of those Marines. No adverse action or judicial action was taken against any of the Marines. And then you see 4 years later in 2019, the Department of Navy says, remove this adverse material from my, Major Fred Galvin's, official military personnel file. Let me ask you a question, real Jackie, kind of personal. On a scale of 1 to 10 on attractiveness, you see a guy like General Mattis in his 70s. What would you rate him on an attractiveness scale of 1 to 10? Just tell me, Jackie.
He would be a 1.2.
Okay. So do you think it's logical that he married a woman half his age who's she's an intellect, she's a very successful entrepreneur, a multimillionaire, she's been a CEO? I mean, is that realistic that he just walked into a bar in Las Vegas and met this woman and she just fell in love with somebody that is very unlikely to be a father and anything that probably a woman her age with her attractiveness would like? Or do you think there's something else going on behind the scenes that people who desire power need to have in the form of a relationship? So watch out what's going to come next from people like this.
So it must have been very difficult for you to watch Mattis be lionized, glorified in the early years of the Trump administration. And as you know, obviously they had a very high profile falling out.
Yes.
But what you're describing, because I used to work on Capitol Hill for years, these are the kinds of things that people know who are in that world. In other words, it pains me because I see the same thing happen in the civilian world. You know, people who we knew were, I don't know if I want to say total sellouts, but let's just say not fully committed for all the right reasons in my eyes to the cause, being promoted. And that happens in Washington all too often. Tell me this, when did you get your acquittal? When did that happen?
It's very interesting, and it happened in two phases. So the quasi-acquittal was, it happened 4 months after the trial. This has never in American history occurred where in a legal court of law, they wait 4 months. But in our case, where so many general officers had their hands all over this tar baby,
right?
They conveniently waited till Friday night on the 23rd of May, 2008, and they gave it to one news source, S.S. Thompson, Associated Press. And they didn't use any legal terms, Jackie. They didn't use a term like innocent, guilty, dismissed. Those are the three options that I or any other military commander had when we have military justice cases. They didn't use any, they said we acted appropriately. And then they later backtracked and said, well, this wasn't a court martial. We couldn't say that they were innocent. But then you had General Mattis, who's the convening authority for the Hadith cases as well. He was in charge of all Marines in the Middle East. He said in the case of Lance Corporal Sherratt, who unfortunately this fall committed suicide, but he said, and he was a Marine in the Hadith case, which went to Article 32. It didn't even go into court. So the case precedent by Mattis himself, our convening authority, said, in my eyes and eyes of law, you are innocent. So he publicly stated that, wrote it in an official letter. But the military can't have straight talk out of them. And it's just a shame that these guys got out of there and then they testifying to Congress in official statements, which I have copies of all this, stating that there's no adverse information. And God bless Catherine Kesselmeyer, general counsel for the Department of the Navy, the day that Mattis was fired from being Secretary of Defense, she signed on the 2nd of January, 2019, a 12-page letter, which has been in the media, and it states, remove this adverse information, which the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Dunford, who went on to become the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who worked for Lockheed Martin, very well off, but he lied to Congress, felony offense. And when you look at these people, you really have to, a guy like Mattis saying, you know, you got to carry a knife around because you never know when you need to cut some cake or stab somebody. Warriors don't talk like that. Somebody that's actually had to face somebody who was wielding a weapon, firing it at them, fully automatic, where you could see the sweat on their face. They're humble. They don't talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
You have some cowards who've never had to face somebody eye to eye who is intending to murder them, kill them. They talk like that.
Right.
And you look at,
no, that makes perfect sense.
Read the book, A Few Bad Men.
It makes sense.
It will disturb you.
I have to go to break, but before I do, give me a really quick time frame. You were, the year that you were charged, the year that you were quasi. Okay, 2007. So right before the election, conveniently, as you pointed out. And then what year were you acquitted the first time?
In 2008, they used a quasi-acquittal saying that we were acted appropriately. But that's where all the press kept doing their drive-bys. And then in 2019, Catherine Kesemeyer released that 12-page document that was very explicit and said what actions were taken against us were immoral and unjust. It named names. And that's what's in the book. And that happened in 2019. Okay. The day, or actually the month after the late Congressman Walter Jones, God bless his soul, died. And he said, Major Gowland, if it's the last thing I do, I'm going to clear your Marines' names.
Oh,
and
I love
and
him.
That was what he did, the last thing.
I loved him. I loved him. Yes. When I worked in Congress, he was there as a congressman. He was a wonderful, sweet man. Okay, I have to go to break. I have no choice. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Major Fred Galvin. He is the author of A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. And this is a true story by someone who served over 26 years, including in MARSOC. Some of you know that's Marine Corps Special Operations Command, and who led hundreds of combat missions in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gulf of Aden, and elsewhere, telling the story of how, after surviving an ambush, a horrific ambush, which involved being attacked by the Taliban on all sides, an improvised explosive device, and clearly a situation where you might not be expected to escape with your life, having survived all that, he then is on the wrong end of what appeared to be, what I believe to be, politically motivated generals who needed a public enemy, a punching bag, a villain, to frame a narrative in a time of war. But ultimately, and here's the important part, he was acquitted. As I'm seeing over and over and over again, you get acquitted when the case against you is political in the first place. When it was trumped up, when there were no facts to support it, when any prosecutor with integrity would exercise discretion and not bring the case. And we're seeing it now over and over again. I'm trying to report on every case I can find like this. So, Major Galvin, my first question is, you were acquitted. Was everyone acquitted?
Yes.
Okay.
So they found... You know, one of the reasons they went with a court of inquiry versus a court martial, Jackie, was that there was no prima facie evidence. There's no bodies. There's no photos of bodies. There's no bullets. There was nothing to tie where a crime had been committed. It was hearsay and conjecture. And again, read the 79 statements recorded by Naval Criminal Investigative Service investigating officers of Afghans that are in Appendix 3 of A Few Bad Men. And you read that, and you're like, you would have to be void of any intellect whatsoever to believe how contradictory they are and take that. But that's what they were going with. They wanted to prove that because, one, the Marine Corps didn't want a Special Operations Command. That's an insult. That's like your husband bringing his girlfriend home to meet you. And it's the biggest insult to every Marine that there is somebody else that is more elite, better trained, the new person that everybody's eclipsing the other Marines. They don't like that. So then you have this inner service rivalry from the Army who we were working for over there. People made decisions so hastily, and I, you know, as a leader here at Tesla, I every day have to restrain, even though this has happened to me, but this is a huge lesson point for me, that you cannot rush to conclusions. You have to be patient. That's why our system of government is based on laws, that we don't rush to judgment, that we don't show bias and discrimination and let that run rampant. We don't have partiality in our decisions. You take the time to investigate with the evidence that there is. You don't manufacture evidence. And when it was all said and done, you go back to talk about Walter Jones. He had House Resolution 21, Jackie. This was in the 115th Congress from 2017 to 2019. And it was stating the purpose was to have the Commandant of the Marine Corps make an official statement that the Marines on the 4 March 2007 patrol from our Special Operations Company were not at fault in that ambush. The Commandant of the Marine Corps for 2 years was indifferent, did not say a single word. So my point is, when you ask about the acquittal, is no, yes, there was a board of three senior civilians in the Department of the Navy, which the Marines is in the department or the men's department. And those three civilians looked at all the facts. They took a year to determine what actually happened. And then they released a statement signed not by Mattis when he could have done it as a Secretary of Defense. Still, you had such jellyfish leaders from our military, both in uniform and civilian. General Mattis, when he was Secretary of Defense, this happened on his watch. He failed to do it. And thank God for the persistence of Congressman Walter Jones and a woman who I've never met, Catherine Kesemeyer, the general counsel at the time for the Department of the Navy. She was the one that bottom line that released on the 2nd of January. But they had made their decision in May of 2018, and it sat there in the Pentagon with no action for the better part of a year until Mattis, the day after he was fired by Trump. And my point in all this is, what's the so what? We look right now, present tense, what's going on in Eastern Europe by a numerical superior force with the Russian army going to a standstill with the technology they have. Everybody's seen, you know, they're devastating attack helicopters, all their aircraft, the massive technology at a standstill by Ukraine. And yes, we're not going to get into how we arm and what we're doing. One of the key ingredients is something that, you know, I was crazy enough to join as a civilian and serve 4 more years with the Department of Defense until earlier this year. And all I saw, this is being stationed in Hawaii, where the wives weren't upset that their husbands weren't deploying to war anymore. They weren't upset because they just enjoyed all the time at the beach or that they had better job offers in Waikiki. That was never the case. But what I saw for 4 years was people wanting out of our military so badly. They have such massive exodus of highly skilled labor and leadership, senior leaders. They want out because we have this ridiculous critical race theory and all this wokeness being shoved down the throats. We can't even get people to recruit. We have a problem because the military, oftentimes it's a family business, and the uncles and the cousins who served a lot of times from the heartland, and where I'm from in Kansas, people are telling their relatives, don't join.
Yeah.
Do something else. And we're not able to fill our ranks. So we better be very careful when we can't man our forces, when they're leaving in droves. These are quality leaders, and some of the ones that are there, I could tell you stories offline about how ridiculous and woke our force is. We're going to pay a price if China decides to push 96 miles east and take Taiwan. And there will be people who become filthy rich, unfortunately,
right,
if they lodge into the only way to dislodge the People's Liberation Army from Taiwan will be through amphibious and airborne operations. And Jackie, I don't think Americans can fathom what the loss in lives and the fortunes that, I mean, we just spent $7 trillion we've added that to our debt since 2020. It's going to be exponentially, the spending will go parabolic, and that will get some people filthy rich,
yep.
But it is not the way we're supposed to be treating and gambling with the lives of sons and daughters of America that are serving our country, Jackie.
No, I agree completely. And I think that really one of the things that sold me on Donald Trump when he was a candidate, because I was not sold for a long time. He wasn't my first, second, or third choice, but he said there will be a lifetime ban on lobbying for anyone who's appointed in my administration. Now, I'm not sure how he would enforce that, but I think that it should be a law. Anyone who served at the highest levels or as congressional staff, I was there for 7 years, under no circumstances should you be permitted to either work for a foreign government, which is what they all do at the highest levels.
Yes.
Or
pimps.
Yeah. Or you go to the top, as you just said, the top five, big five defense firms or other technology firms that make lots of money off of warfare, and yeah. including warfare for people who are not our friends. So I saw firsthand how that worked, the assembly line. And it doesn't matter, from what I saw, whether you are Democrat or Republican. It really no. didn't matter. Both sides were more than happy to go to work for people who I thought were entirely questionable, but they found a way to justify it. You gave some examples. That just needs to be illegal. You should have to choose. You're either a general in the U.S. military, or you're working for a foreign government or a defense firm later in life. One or the other. You can't be both, because otherwise, I don't see how we prevent adversaries from dangling carrots in front of them while they're on the job to do any number of things against the American best interest. So that's my analysis or take on what you told us. And let me just reset here. I'm talking to Major Fred Galvin, and he did more than 26 years in the Marine Corps, both enlisted and as an officer, Marine Corps Special Operations Command, or MARSOC, hundreds of combat missions. Buy his book. It's called A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. This man and those who served beside him were wrongly prosecuted, persecuted, humiliated, I'm sure, dragged through the media circus, and then acquitted of all alleged wrongdoing. Why? Because that means the case was political. There were no facts to support it in the first place. All I can say is, the only silver lining here is that the American system ultimately still has some parts that work. At least you were acquitted. We got the truth ultimately. It only took them, 12 years to get that done, which is shameful. And I'm really, really sorry that you had to go through this. But I want to tell these stories as often as I can. These are true stories of great Americans who are on the wrong end of the highest levels of their government. So, Major Galvin, thank you so much for your service, for everything you've done. Really, the fight that you had was for all Americans. You set a precedent there in what was the longest trial in Marine Corps history, and you fought and you won. So I'm so proud of you, and but still just feeling more than anything disgusted by what you told me. I'm sick at my stomach, and all of America needs to hear this and open our eyes to what is happening. So Major Galvin, again, thank you for your service.
Thank you very much, Jackie. And one last thing to reiterate what you mentioned previously is our founding fathers spoke about exactly what you said. And it's in Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution. In America, we better know our Constitution, or it's about ready to be disappeared by or torn up by some of our elected officials, which we call so-called leaders. That Section 3 talks about treason, and that it's specifically defined in our Constitution as anyone who gives aid or abetment to our enemy. And when you look at and you read A Few Bad Men, this is not Fred Galvin stating it. It took me 11 years. Had to get two attorneys, had to sue the Special Operations Command and the Marine Central Command to release the original investigation and to get the courtroom transcripts to write this book, because what I described to you is not Jason Bourne's knock list or the locations of submarines at sea. This is gun battle.
Yep.
And they classified it to protect those senior officers' comments that never needed to be classified. They didn't need to continue throughout 3.5 weeks, move the media out of the courtroom. That is censor. We do not allow that. Our First Amendment prohibits it. And in the security classification guide of the military, it says classifying anything to save somebody for the purpose of embarrassment is illegal. So, but you see these people that these were known terrorists that attacked us. That information is now in the book. It's been declassified. Who these people were, that they paid 4 years average Afghan salary to the three members that were in that vehicle that were shot. That was a known terrorist that ducked out, that testified live from a military base on video teleconference. When you read this, I'm just giving a tease. There's actually another case that I was involved in also in Afghanistan about an American officer dropping bombs on I'll just tease that. And you read about what happened there and how his words were, I'm willing to sacrifice the lives of these Marines for the greater good for this Hearts and Minds campaign. And you wonder why after 20 years we lost that war. Don't question it. We lost it. And now you'll figure out why when you read this book, and there will be no question of why they left $7 billion worth of war material when you have all these generals that are, when you fly into Washington, D.C., whether it's Reagan or Dulles, look at the names on the tops of those buildings around the Pentagon and the intelligence community. Check out the boards, the members of the boards of directors, and see how many of them are selling these products around the globe to our adversaries. That's exactly what Section 3 of our Constitution talked about, aiding and abetting our enemies.
To the tune of tens of billions of dollars of what you're talking about left behind in Afghanistan, someone made a lot of money off all of that.
And we gave one-third of our Javelin missiles, and that's right, it's a joint project made by Raytheon, where current Secretary of Defense just came from, Lloyd Austin, and he's an infantry officer like myself, as is General Nicholson, who retired, who condemned us, as is General Dunford, who lied to Congress saying there's nothing. They both work for Lockheed. And this joint venture that makes these missiles, these Javelin missiles, which the Ukraine's were handed to them, a third of our war supply, 5,000 of these things, doesn't really matter if you're going to be able to make more. That's why they have, it's not a no general left behind program to keep these old lads off the street. They're doing fine.
Yeah.
But they have placement and access. They know you can't get into the Pentagon unless you're a VIP, and that is a retired O-10. That's why they hire them, if they worked in the Pentagon. As soon as they retire, they get them because placement and access. And that's why you have all this wokeness in our military, because they will go along with whatever the Senate and House Armed Services Committees want, because they know that's who approves the promotion list, and they don't want straight shooters at the senior ranks. They want jellyfish leaders and weak-kneed leaders that'll buckle and promote every goofy thing that the base of these members of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee push down their throat. And because that's what will get them reelected. Mm-hmm. And it's a game. And we're all going to suffer because of it, Jackie.
Oh, I believe you completely. I am completely and totally convinced by that. And you're kind of peeling back the layers of the onion to show why things happen. Why this mystery of leaving all that equipment behind in Afghanistan? Why all this wokeness? This kind of unlocks the mystery. So we're keeping in mind that the Congress is the body that hands out the appropriations to the military. And to the defense contracting firm. So the money comes from us through those committees you just named, authorized and appropriated. Okay, I'm totally out of time, but please do buy Major Galvin's book. It's titled A Few Bad Men, The True Story of U.S. Marines Ambushed in Afghanistan and Betrayed in America. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Find me online at jackiedaly.com, on Facebook, and on Twitter at Jackie Daly Host. I have on the line my friend Ron Ness. He is the director over at the Council, or a director at the Council for a Secure America, and also president of the North Dakota Petroleum Council, as well as an avid outdoorsman and conservationist on the board of directors for the Mule Deer Foundation. That would excite my household. And the Missouri River Advisory Council. Ron, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on today, Jackie. I'm actually on my way out to pheasant hunt with some of my Petroleum Council members tomorrow.
You know what? Almost to the rule, the people I hunt with and fish with are oil men, and most oil and gas people are hunters, fishermen, and conservationists. I find this almost across the board, especially if you attend Dallas Safari Club meetings. My goodness, the overlap is remarkable. So,
well, as you speak, we actually have a group of folks out in western North Dakota in our beautiful Badlands, which are covered with snow today, doing a habitat project with the Mule Deer Foundation. So the North Dakota Petroleum Council has been a huge partner with the Mule Deer Foundation. They're doing a fence restoration project today, so you have fence that are more hospitable to mule deer and whitetail deer and elk and all of those things that we have in western North Dakota. So despite a well, actually, it's a pretty nice day in North Dakota, but we're glad to be out there. And you're right. folks in the energy industry are just simply, we love the outdoors, and you know, anything that suggests that we would do anything that would hurt the environment in North Dakota, we have the cleanest air, the cleanest water, and some of the greatest outdoors and habitat in the world. So,
well, that's for sure. And you also have some of the most prolific drilling and in your case, fracking now. I remember when right here in northern Texas, because I'm in Dallas, just north of us is the Barnett Shale. And there was a claim for a long time that we had cancer clusters because of hydraulic fracturing. And I said to everyone, you know, this isn't the most fracked land in America. Not even close. Like, if fracking causes cancer, completely unsubstantiated claim, but a film was made about it, then you would expect to see it all over the country where we frack, right? That would mean certainly North Dakota, Pennsylvania, like five different shale plays in Texas. I mean, all over the place. But people get by with claims like this because most of us can't prove or disprove it all on our own. And I haven't heard that in a long time since the fracking fight was won here. Suddenly everyone forgot about cancer. So I haven't heard about that. But up there where you are, Ron, in North Dakota, where you have more millionaires per capita than any other state, and I would think some of the most friendly population toward oil and gas, what is your controversy up there? Or is there one?
Well, Jackie, let's just step back a minute and recognize that fracking stimulation in the rock 2 miles beneath the earth, which that oil and natural gas is plant and organic matter, which was very natural 320 million years ago in the Bakken. That's been going on since the 1940s across this country. And the reason you don't hear about it anymore, because it was a lie and it was a myth that's been debunked. Not one validated, proven case. There's 2 miles of zones, geological barriers between that oil and that gas that went out of the ground anyways because of the incredible pressure of all that rock on top of it. So it's not an issue because it was a lie and it was a myth. So, you know, the challenge that we have now in North Dakota, we've got this incredible resource. Certainly you are right. The natural gas, the horizontal drilling was really in that Dallas-Fort Worth Barnett Shale. But really, when you look at oil shale plays across the world now, what we did in the Bakken, we were the leading and the first out of the box in terms of how to produce oil out of shale. And what we've done here, we've been at the tip of the spear for everything and all the learning curves, but incredible resource that we have in the Bakken in North Dakota, producing about 1.1 million barrels of oil a day. We peaked at 1.5 million just prior to COVID, and certainly been rebounding from that. But you know, our big challenges now are the challenges of really fighting our own federal government for the ability to produce, fighting these regulations, fighting Wall Street and the other areas which have put a stranglehold on capital. So, and of course, there's a lot of other great shale plays. So we're now competing with those great shale plays across the country for capital to drill and explore for more Bakken oil. We know it's here, and certainly it's a tremendous resource and so valuable to our state.
I know it's your position that the words of our leaders matter. What difference does it make out there in North Dakota if the president is encouraging the production of natural gas versus attacking the production or oil?
Jackie, I testified before the U.S. Senate Energy Subcommittee in July, and those are the very words that I used. The words of our leaders do matter. They drive markets. They drive investment. They drive the mindset of young people wanting to go into the oil and gas and fossil fuel sector. So when we think about high energy prices and high costs and inflationary mechanisms tied to that, I think we know where to point the finger, and Americans know where to point the finger. So the question becomes, are we going to beg our foes across the world like Venezuela and the OPEC nations and other nations to send us more oil and natural gas and outsource our guilt, I guess, or are we going to support American energy production right here in North Dakota, Texas, Oklahoma, Wyoming, and across this incredible country of ours. We've got vast resources. We can produce them here much more economically friendly, much more environmentally friendly. I contend that we have the cleanest barrel of oil right here in the Bakken. Our environmental footprint is a fraction of what you've seen anywhere else across the world using this incredible new technology.
Right. So, you know, if we don't get our oil from you guys in North Dakota, it ends up coming from places that are very unsavory, from America's enemies, people who have waged war against us, openly sometimes, in the case of certain OPEC nations, or at least their citizens certainly have. And so why would we do that? What do you think the impact has been of, for example, the war by Russia against Ukraine? Has that impacted North Dakota?
Jackie, certainly I believe that in the years when America was energy dominant, and that was just 2.5 years ago, in the years in which we could supply our friends and allies across the world, we had cheap American energy, affordable, our economy was growing. Putin and Russia didn't have the resources to generate trouble like this. We weren't seeing the trouble abroad because, you know, we put our enemies at a disadvantage because we weren't funding their wars or whatever it is with our money that we're paying them for oil. And as oil prices went up, you saw that increase in their activities go up. So why we would not make American energy, why we would not encourage and support American energy. In North Dakota, you look at 1 in 5 North Dakotans who work directly or indirectly for the oil and gas industry. It derives 53% of every dollar that the state of North Dakota takes in comes from oil and natural gas production taxes. We are now the youngest state. Prior to the Bakken, we were the oldest state.
Really?
We are seeing a boom in population. We've got young people moving here, coming back here, creating families, jobs. We got schools. Instead of closing schools like we were 15 years ago, we're building schools. This is an economic renaissance, and really a renaissance for America to be able to produce energy. And in addition to that, of course, we tell the Canadians that we don't want their oil by canceling the Keystone XL pipeline. This country receives a lot of oil from we're more friendly than Canada, but no, we don't want Canadian oil either. So it means that in the absence of all of that, you must want energy prices to rise to make your agenda work is all I can come up with.
Right. So I'm going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to speak to Ron Ness further about inflation. I don't think that the average American is told by our leadership or by our media why. What happens in places like North Dakota or the oil patch anywhere is impacting the price of everything you're buying. I'm going to argue every single item you're buying. I'm going to argue when we come back that you haven't bought one thing in the last 30 days that either wasn't made with oil, out of oil, transported to you with fossil fuels, or manufactured with fossil fuels. Maybe not oil, but almost certainly natural gas and coal. So I'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with Ron Ness. He is the president of the North Dakota Petroleum Council and also on the board of the Council for a Secure America. So, Ron, where we left off was inflation. It's like supposedly the number one issue in the last election. Everybody understands this. Everyone notices it. It's unavoidable. Doesn't matter your income bracket. We all notice. When I see on a poll that the number one issue is inflation, what I'm thinking is what you really mean is the number one issue is energy production. To me, oil and natural gas and coal are sort of the biggest built-in cost of everything that we buy. I don't see a way around that. Ron, can you explain better, you know, differently than I have, why the price of oil and gas and coal makes the price of everything else?
Well, Jackie, in North Dakota, we consider ourselves the breadbasket of America. We produce, I think we lead the country in the production of many agricultural products And of course, we're now the third largest oil and gas producing state in the country. And you look at a bushel of corn or a bushel of wheat, the input costs that go into that bushel of corn and wheat, a lot of it is, of course, the diesel fuel in order to till and harvest your fields, the fertilizer that's derived from natural gas that goes on those crops to, of course, increase the productivity and manage the weed growth, and all of the components that go into that really are energy related. In addition to that, of course, ethanol and biodiesel are a derivative of our agriculture industry. So, and then you begin to look across not only the transportation sector, but really everything. As we move through the holidays, I challenge people to take a look at the things that they utilize during Thanksgiving and Christmas. Take a look at the not only the way that what gets them from point A to point B, but all of the things that we touch every day, derivatives, as you said, of natural gas. So when you drive the price up of those commodities, you're going to drive up the price of everything that's delivered, every turkey that's grown, every turkey that's delivered to the market. Costs are going up. We see that in airline tickets. We see that at the grocery stores. We see that in the commodities on the shelves of stores. So, and certainly this winter, we're going to have high home heating costs. That is going to be a big concern. We've seen oil prices moderate a slight bit here in the past few weeks, but the metrics aren't good long term. We are not producing enough energy in this country in order to meet the demand long term. So we got to make that change. And Americans, I hope when they went to the polls and they talked about inflation, I hope they tied that back to energy, because you're spot on. It's all about the energy we produce, the commodities that we grow. That's what drives not only our food and fuel in this country, but really our economy.
Well, and it almost feels like a tax increase when we have these hostile policies out of Washington or the states against energy production, then there's less of it. So it's more expensive. And that's money out of our pocket. I remember Donald Trump said that when he was in office, we'd save so much money on gasoline. It was like the average family got a $1,700 check back. You don't notice that. You don't realize what's happening there. But it's the, you know, life without the now 90-some hostile Biden policies that I've counted against oil and gas and fossil fuels. So we, you know, to get ourselves back to where we were 2 years ago, I really think the answer is very simple. And it's simply, it's not passing laws, it's repealing laws. Those 90-some hostile actions taken, and voila, magic happens. I think to the other side, that the side that's hostile to energy production, it must seem like magic. I think the Trump economy must have seemed like magic. I wonder if they even understand what's causing that and what the issue is there. You do government relations. How would you gauge the sophistication of the average? I mean, you're North Dakota. It's a sophisticated state. Do you do any federal work? I'm curious. Speak with your federal people.
If you're in any business right now, you better be doing federal work.
Yeah.
Just this week alone, the EPA released two new regulations, really trying to, you know, reduce, delay the ability to produce fossil fuels and really draconian type regulations, much worse than what we saw during the Obama era. These regulations really only have one purpose, and that's they're somewhat masked under climate and environmental justice and all of these things. But we are seeing policies that, you know, you wake up every day and the federal government's out to limit your ability to produce what you do. And it's a huge challenge. So, you know, I would say that there was one thing about the Trump administration and President Trump. He quickly put together the ability to say, you know, if we produce more energy here, we not only hurt our enemies geopolitically across the world, but we grow our economy. And you're right. We reduce the cost for Americans and our own citizens. So he visited the Bakken twice, actually. And right before he became president, and then shortly after he became president, he visited North Dakota because he recognized. I don't think a businessman from New York City really had a lot of knowledge about what was going on, but he was quickly able to put the puzzle pieces together and recognize if we can encourage and promote American energy production, American agricultural production, it's good for our economy, it's good for our country, and it's good for us in the world. So that's the policies we have to get back to. Energy does not need to be a political football, Jackie. I've said that time and time again. We don't need to elect more Republicans if we just ensure that Democrats across this country understand what it means to their constituents. Like you said, it's a tax increase. If prices are going up, you're paying more at the pump, you're paying more at home, paying more inflationary. And if we encourage it and support it, the costs go down. And yet, where else in the world can we do it cleaner, more efficiently? The discussion about a transition by 2025, 2030 to all renewables, we're not going to transition to weather-related type of energy supply. We need a reliable, affordable energy. That means we need oil, coal, natural gas. The world is continuing to peak at population levels. We're consuming more and more energy every day. Our younger people are really energy addicts.
Yes.
They need energy tied to them all day long with all of the devices, all of the things that you think about, the number of TVs in their homes. We need more energy. So renewables is an important part of this going forward, but it can't be one or the other. It's got to be both.
I have never thought of the point that you just made, which is that the younger generation is far more fossil fuel intensive and more addicted to fossil fuels than my generation. I mean, like, I'm in my 40s. I never had an email account until I went to college. I was 18 years old. So for the first 18 years of my life, there was no email. There were no smartphones. In fact, there were no portable phones at all where I'm from in Appalachia. So imagine the difference in the energy that I use versus the energy that these kids use. They're so much more committed to the high burn, high intensity fossil fuel lifestyle, yet they think they're hostile. But in fact, their actions suggest otherwise. How do we get this message across, Ron? I've got like 1 minute.
Well, Jackie, I think one of the easy things is to ask them, what are you willing to give up?
Right, right.
Are you willing to give up your phone? Oh, by the way, that phone is made out of natural gas, coal. It's powered typically by coal. Are you willing to give up all the things that you plug in? How many TVs do you have in your home? How many refrigerators? How many, you know, and then we begin talking electric cars. So I think people get it. I think they understand the value of American resources, what it means in the world, and recognizing we've just went past Veterans Day. Wars are fought over energy.
Right.
And we have to recognize the importance to this country. We cannot weaken ourselves and put ourselves at China's mercy because we now need the energy sources they have in the terms of lithium and those things that they control 85% of that in the world. We are going to be at the mercy of China. And that's just crazy.
Yep, and that is where we're headed. If we'd like to be like Germany, we should just keep on keeping on, becoming more dependent on those who might or might not have our best interest in mind. I'm talking with Ron Ness, and he is a director at the Council for a Secure America, also the president of the North Dakota Petroleum Council. Ron, thanks so much for coming on. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. We'll take a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Follow me on Twitter at Jackie Daly Host. Also on Instagram, Jackie Daly. So I picked up a copy of the Belmont Law Review and found that one of my former classmates from Vanderbilt is the faculty advisor for this review. And it wasn't random. I was at the Steamboat Institute Energy Conference, and one of the speakers, his name is Lakshman Guru Swami, not to be confused with Vivek Ramaswamy, one of my favorite guests of all time, also one of my favorite authors. But this man wrote an article titled Global Energy Poverty, The Relevance of Faith and Reason. Again, Global Energy Poverty, The Relevance of Faith and Reason. I thought it was interesting that the Law Review would be writing on this topic, it's really probably the number one topic for helping the younger generation understand why they are pro-fossil fuels. They think they are anti-fossil fuels. As I say in a separate segment, or more accurately, one of my guests said in a separate segment of this show, Ron Ness, the younger generation is actually the most energy intensive, far more so than I ever was. The time they spend in front of a screen or two, I mean, by the age of 18, probably surpasses all the time I've spent in my entire life, and I'm twice their age. So they are addicted. They just don't know it. But aside from pointing out what's frankly their hypocrisy for all the oil, gas, and coal and nuclear they use in their life, I don't know if they think it's all coming off a wind turbine or a solar panel or what they believe, but the other piece to it that I think appeals to that age group is they genuinely are concerned and aware of people on the other side of the planet, out of 8 billion of us, you know, fully 1.3 billion do not have reliable electricity. And what that means is they live in squalor, and not just squalor. It's not just being poor. And I mean, truly poor, not poor like the way that the U.S. federal government defines, you know, the poverty line in this country. In this country, you can be well below the poverty line, be overweight, have 2.5 television sets, a cell phone, a roof over your head. We're talking about something completely different. That is what poverty looks like in the United States, in a wealthy country that has all, historically, the energy that it needs. But if you are on the other side of the world, you are the one suffering the most where we have scarcity of energy. It is a life or death issue. It is no exaggeration to say to the millennials, to Generation Z, you have to understand that when you're advocating, like Greta Thunberg, to roll back the use of fossil fuels, which are powering 80% of the world's energy for 8 billion people, you are talking about taking human life. I mean, there are no two ways about it. You are talking about taking human life. That is no exaggeration. And this Law Review article, again, Belmont Law Review, titled Global Energy Poverty, The Relevance of Faith and Reason, gives just a tiny little snapshot as to what life is like in the developing world, especially sub-Saharan Africa or the developing parts of Asia. And we've talked about this before at length, how the UN reports that women and girls spend the overwhelming majority of their waking hours just fetching water, just drinking water, because they don't have electricity to pump it to their house the way you and I do. It's just that simple. That is why they don't have water, and it's not sanitized. They don't have modern sanitation because you need chemicals for that, and you need hydrocarbons, that is oil and gas, to be refined and also split out into its various, you know, chemical components to create chemicals for sanitation. They don't have that either. The biggest divider, and what I'm really proud of this Law Review article for saying, the biggest divider between the haves and the have-nots globally is how much energy do you have? And specifically, how much fossil fuels do you have? Or nuclear is also acceptable as a reliable source. So France is 70% nuclear, approximately. That works too. But it has to be an all-the-time thing. It can't be, you know, energy that you have when the sun shines or when the wind blows. And this is what happens. I've seen stories about hospitals in Rwanda, for example, where they might have just a few solar panels to run a hospital. And so the hospital has power when the sun is shining for a while. That is all. If you are an infant in a neonatal intensive care unit, you almost certainly will lose your life in a hospital run on solar panels. It's that simple. So I appreciated, and I'd never, ever, ever thought of this before. This article cites to sociologists and economists to explain why energy makes you wealthy, or at least not poor. And I have to confess, in my years of thinking about this, I've never, ever thought of it through the sociologist's eyes. I suppose we speak in those terms, but we don't say it quite that way. Sociologists are not typically the people who are out there making the case for why we need robust energy production. But in fact, they have, because they directly link it to whether or not you had the basic things that you need to stay alive. And so specifically Herbert Spencer, not exactly a conservative, not exactly a libertarian, but a very widely renowned sociologist, groundbreaking sociologist. He was the first to articulate that a society's ability to harness energy defines what it can produce, and that the ability to control and use energy is the basis of both social progress and disparities among societies. In other words, I've often said, if I could teach a college class on any topic I wanted, I think what I do is start it out by saying, okay, everyone explain to me, why is, let's say, Cambodia looking the way it looks, that is underdeveloped largely, versus why the United States looks the way it looks? How do we wind up in two totally different realities? How do you explain that? I'm not sure what a college class would say, but my guess is that they would not understand what Herbert Spencer, the famous sociologist, just said, which is that the ability to control and use energy is the basis of social progress and disparities among societies. And it's not just a polite conversation. As I just said, it's life and death, truly. And then this article moves on to an anthropologist in the 1950s. Leslie White conceptualized cultural evolution as a movement along a continuum where progress is defined in terms of a linear path from poor to advanced energy use. Wow, this person sounds like me. I mean, I'm no progressive, and I don't think we're at the end of history or anything like that. But this anthropologist clearly connected moving along the continuum of progress, however they define that, as whether or not you are able to go from poor to advanced energy use. It's brazen. It's explicit. So this person says, Leslie White, society's ability to exploit new and better forms of energy drives development, and access to energy dictates the progress of peoples. Quote, culture advances as the amount of energy harnessed per capita per year increases, or as the means of controlling energy is increased. And this is kind of amazing. He concluded there was little cultural growth until the 19th century and the discovery of fossil fuels. And he argued the invention of fossil fuel-powered engines inaugurated a new era in cultural history. By tremendously increasing the amount of energy under man's control and at his disposal for culture building. I think that's kind of amazing. This guy is saying, you know, we wouldn't have had the Beatles, okay, without there being enormous amounts of energy brought under our command. And so I hadn't thought about that, but if you think carefully about the history of mankind, this makes sense. I mean, the life expectancy didn't change much for 2,000 years. And then came the Industrial Revolution. And you went from an average life of like 40 years to 47 years to now all the way up to maybe 80, depending on where you are. So, rather amazing. Learned a lot from this article. Didn't agree with a lot of it, but it's the point is that the social sciences, even the pillars of certain social sciences, they even cite to Kant and others, definitely recognize that if you want to progress and come out on top and develop culturally and otherwise, you have to have lots of energy under your command. This is what people recognized in the 20th century. Wars were fought over it. This was well understood, but fell out of fashion eventually. For all kinds of reasons I don't have time to explore at this second. Going to break, you're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. I want to share with you just some examples of what can happen, particularly to women and girls and children, when they don't have access to affordable, reliable energy. This, again, coming from Belmont Law Review, an article entitled Global Energy Poverty, The Relevance of Faith and Reason by Lakshman Guruswamy. Great, quick examples here of what life is like without adequate fossil fuels. If you want to know what net zero would look like, well, here it is. First, you'll have to cook with biomass. That means instead of turning on your gas-powered stove or your electric stove or oven, you burn over a fire, just like these 715 million people who have no other choice. This is what the future looks like. You're burning animal dung, waste, crop residues, rotted wood, and raw coal. So this causes indoor air pollution with a variety of very dangerous pollutants, like truly dangerous pollution, not the kind we have here in the States. We have some of the cleanest air on Earth, which is amazing. We burn more energy per capita than almost anyone, but we have the best technology for cleaning the air. It's that simple. But if you don't, and if you cook with organic biomass, again, dung, rotted wood, waste, etc., then your home will contain excessive, like way excessive, carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide, sulfur oxides, formaldehyde, carcinogens like benzene, like the smell that you smell from gasoline. That's the smell of cancer. And small particulate matter. Particulate matter, sometimes called PM or PM2.5. Very dangerous. This will bring on pneumonia, chronic pulmonary disease, lung cancer, asthma, and acute respiratory infections. Using biomass for cooking results in an estimated 3.5 million premature deaths per year. 3.5 million people die every year because of this, and many millions more get sick. Mortality and morbidity. Women are twice as likely to be affected with the chronic pulmonary disease than men because they're the ones in the homes cooking with the solid fuels. And in conflict zones, war zones, the search for cooking fuels exposes women and girls to physical and sexual violence. This is documented in places like Darfur, Sudan, or Somalia. Keep in mind, you want to be searching during the day, so you have limited time. If you run out of fuel in the night, you have to go out in the night. And that's part of what brings down this risk. Women, get ready for this, provide 91% of the household's total efforts in collecting fuel and water in these developing countries. Women have an average working day of 11 to 14 hours compared to 10 hours for men. In other words, they spend 11 to 14 hours a day just getting what they need to stay alive for that day. They don't have time for school, you know, education, leisure, rest, all the normal things that you might expect. You're never coming out of that. Nothing changes except that you get access to a lot of reliable energy. It's the difference between millennial or Gen Z. Your life and their life is all the fossil fuels you're gobbling up every day of your life. Or how about lighting? Do you realize without adequate lighting, you would be comparatively inactive for half of your lifetime? Because you only have light half of the time you're alive. Imagine that. So if you live in an extremely hot climate, then the heat of the day keeps you from being able to work in the middle of the day. This is why, like, the Spanish and others have siesta. It's too daggone hot to work in the middle of the day. I lived in Spain for several months. I can tell you, they all go home and go to bed. And this is because for 99% of their history, there was no air conditioning. So they had to rest in the middle of the day. So there goes more of your productivity. You're only working in sunlight. And that severely reduces your agricultural productivity. And that's how you feed your kids. It's how you stay alive. It's how you raise your food. So almost 500 million people rely on kerosene for their light. I remember growing up, we used kerosene to heat the house. I did not realize how dangerous it is. The federal government would give out vouchers for it. So it was cheap for us. But what it does is impair your lung function, causes asthma, cancer, and tuberculosis. Households often spend 10 to 25% of their income on kerosene in developing countries. It's all they have. Again, for lighting. How about drinking water and sanitation? Well, Mr. Guruswamy says that 1 in 8 people, that's about 884 million, lack access to safe water supplies. And that means they have tuberculosis, cholera, and other waterborne diseases because they don't have basic sanitation. Again, you can't have that without fossil fuels and the petrochemicals derived from them. So billions of people lack access to improved sanitation. 1.2 billion people have no facilities at all. None. That means, as a result, 3.5 million people die from water-related diseases every year. 1 in 5 child deaths, again, 1.5 million, is caused by dehydration from these waterborne illnesses. And that is because of unclean drinking water and inadequate sanitation. You must have energy and lots of it to solve these problems. Research in sub-Saharan Africa suggests that women and girls in low-income countries spend 40 billion, with a B, hours a year collecting water. 40 billion. So again, this disproportionately affects women, girls, and children. If you are a millennial or Generation Z, this is supposed to be what you care about. Think about these most vulnerable people on the other side of the world. Why should they be victims of our policy at the United Nations to roll back fossil fuels when you know good and well we have zero intention of cutting our own consumption? Zero. And I thought that Ron Ness from North Dakota Petroleum Council had the best way to present this to people who are younger, the millennials or Generation Z, who think they're anti-fossil fuel. You ask them, this is the best question. What are you prepared to give up? I think it's a great question. You know, at least the vegans give up something that's clear and tangible, supposedly, you know, as a way to meet their idea of morality. Okay, I appreciate that. I respect that. How are you going to give up your fossil fuels, kids? It means no more devices. I mean, devices are a luxury item, right? Phones, computers, you don't need those to stay alive. You think you do. But those of us who were born before 1990 know for a fact. In fact, you don't. Food, water, and shelter are what you need to survive at a minimum. So don't you think it's only right that you give up everything but food, water, and shelter until everyone across the world can have them? Isn't that right? There's only so much energy on Earth. We have to share it, right? So that should be the position of the millennials and Generation Z. If I see them all giving up their cell phones, their iPads, I would take them very seriously. But that day is never going to come. If there's one thing I think I understand about Americans, it's that we don't do sacrifice. We don't even sacrifice instant gratification of a Google search, much less give up the devices. So I don't see this happening. But that's the discussion that needs to be had. The campaign that someone needs to coin for the kids. They're not really kids, they're young adults, but what are you prepared to give up? I mean, we need a whole ad campaign on that, American Petroleum Institute. Why not? If you're going to dump tens of millions of dollars into telling everyone how great you are, maybe it's just better to ask the most introspective question of all that could really drive the issue home and have people be introspective. Some of them are capable. This younger generation takes itself very seriously, right? They think they're so empathetic. And they want to be. They want to do the right thing. They've never had anyone pose the critical questions that cut to the heart of the issue. And Ron Ness did it. I have to say, that is the first time in a long time someone has put it that way. And additionally, as I said, pointed out to me for the first time ever that the younger you are, the more you love your fossil fuels. I don't care what the polls say. There's your talk and there's your action. If we assess the younger generation on talk only, they're the most green. If you assess them on actions only, they're the least green. That's a fact. Take that to your kids and grandkids. In fact, I feel like I should write this down. I feel like I should email it to myself. I mean, I can pull this out every day on somebody. So, anyway, excellent point, Ron Ness. And I'm out of time again. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.